Okay, so I'd like to talk about van der Waals functional, which was developed with a lot of collaborators. The ones that have stars on their names are no longer at the original institutions, but we still collaborate with lots of them. The original functional was developed by a student and myself and another student, Bengt Lundquist, and then lots of people came into play. The ingredients of the functional are very simple. I mean, almost crude. I mean, for the long range part, it's a single pole approximation for the density response function. It satisfies various limits. The pole position is scaled using exact electron gas ground state input. Pole residue from the sum rule has the advantage that it's non-empirical, there's no fitted parameters. And these are the two key references for the original functional. The form of the functional, you can see, is really a non-local thing. Density here is integrated over a double integral. There's a kernel, phi of r and r prime, which is also a functional of the density. It's a functional of the density in a particularly simple way, in that it only involves the density in the vicinity of this point and the vicinity of this point through this function q, which is a function of the density and its gradient. If you, instead of writing it in terms of the r and r prime vectors, if we go to sum and difference vectors, actually involving these q's, what you have here, then you can write it more simply, and you can plot this kernel as a function of the difference variable, or for various different difference variables, as a function of the sum variable. You can think of the black curve as the case where the density is the same at the two points, and the integral under that curve is zero exactly, and that ensures the seamlessness of the approximation. In other words, if you have two Jellium surfaces and you bring them together, then you have no contribution from this. Okay, so let's go on. We made it self-consistent, and this gives you some examples of that. Is, you know, when you get the full VXC that goes with it, it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference. So all our original calculations before we did that are pretty much the same. See, the open circles are non-self-consistent, the solid circles are self-consistent. This picture also gives you something about the accuracies and inaccuracies of it. We tend to do fairly well on the on binding energies. The equilibrium distances, when they're compared with the higher level calculations, are always coming out a little bit too large. Okay, so I go on. I can summarize what some of the strengths and weaknesses of it are. For large systems, the energies come out pretty well. The original ones we did, like rare gas atoms, are quite inaccurate. So the small systems are not so good. This is for van der Waals bonding. For hydrogen bonds, it's kind of okay, but typically they're too weak. The shape of the energy minima are good, a little too shallow. Here's something I mentioned already. The equilibrium separations tend to be too large, rather consistently too large, by something like that. Of course, it's not like bonding at short distances. The hard wall isn't so hard out there, so you got to get things much more accurately to get good distances. In in computer codes, works just like GGA does, and so you can do lots of calculations fairly simply. There's issues with metallic systems. I told you we use a single pole approximation. It's an insulator type dispersion relationship. The polarization function as a function of frequency and wave vector is well behaved. It's finite. For metals, you know, if you let omega and k go to zero at the same time, it's not finite. You get lots of these interesting asymptotic behaviors that we learned about in an earlier talk today, Rubio's talk. That's one of the issues of long-range forms for metallic systems are not going to come out right. Okay, here's an example of energies for a larger system. This is a pair of DNA base pair steps, you know, four base pairs and two steps. All the possible steps going across there, there are 10 of them. They're set at 36 degree rotation because that's where the quantum chemical calculations are. And you know, it's not too bad. We were amazed at that when that came out. Okay, so that's an example of that one. Now, let me tell you, it was a fairly important new development because you notice we have a double integral to do to evaluate the functional. It should take much, much longer than GGA and stuff like that. But Jose Soler and his student have developed a method that kernel is basically factorized, and you do a large number of, a lot of fast Fourier transforms, and it's something that's very efficient. And so, for large systems, the new method is always faster. It's very efficient. I mean, even for smaller systems, 50 atoms, the efficiency difference between the van der Waals and GGA is only about 2%. 150 atom systems, we can't even see the difference. These are timings with Abinit, with a self-consistent VDW added. Okay, this is now available in some publicly available codes. It's available in an alpha version of Siesta now, which is now on their website. It's a full self-consistent implementation, efficient forces, stress tensor, VDW pseudo-potential generation. It's also released as a standalone package with a generous license, which lets it be redistributed if you modify it and stuff like that. So you can put it in your own code and run it and give it to other people, which you can't generally do with the Siesta stuff. It's also available in GPAW, independently coded version using this Solar algorithm, and it's a full consistent implementation. They don't have a stress tensor. It uses PBE, RevPBE PAW setups. Okay, so this is just the paper by Jose Soler and a student that introduced it, and this is a joint paper we did with them up here back to back, applying it to a system that I'd like to tell you about shortly now. Okay, so the application I talk about are hydrogen molecules and nanoporous materials, and I'm just going to really talk about the first one here. Because this is something called MOF-74. You don't have to know what it is. I'll show you a picture of it in a second. But it was picked because there's recent neutron diffraction results. And so we had good comparison. We knew where the molecules were. And in fact, there's inelastic neutron diffraction data measuring the rotational translations, and that made us a challenge to calculate those too. Okay, so here's what it looks like looking into the pores. This is experimental data from neutron diffraction. This is sort of the structure. And the pores go into the slide here. And if you put 24 hydrogens in a unit cell, that's what they did here. Here's where they go. This is experimental. They published the coordinates of all of them. These are all at different depths. There's several different sites. There's a site associated with the zinc atom, which is the big purple one there. Another site that's associated with a trigonal of oxygen atoms, and a third site which is associated with this benzene type ring down here. So first thing we did was to see if we could reproduce that. There's the same slide again. So what we did was put 24 hydrogen molecules per unit cell in there, and let it relax overnight. And this is what we get. Of course, here, this is experimental. There's one point at the peak of the hydrogen wave function. Here we're looking for a minima and the potential. So you see the two parts of the atoms and how they turn around. The thing at the zinc site, they're a little bit too far from the zinc atom, as we always find. These two are they're actually a little too far apart too. They're at different depths, so they're not, you can't see it here. But it worked out fairly well. And now we tried to calculate the energies. There's two different independent experimental heat of absorption measurements, about 90 MeV each one for the lowest, the highest binding site. If you do GGA, you get 46 MeV with no zero point correction. You do LTA, it's way overbind as usual, overbound, 230 MeV. We do our thing, it was 130 MeV with no zero point correction. We did the zero point correction, I'll talk about it in a second, and you come down to 100 MeV, which is getting into the ballpark of what the experiment is. Well, we don't always do that well, but it worked out well for this one. Okay, so to calculate these zero point energies, we do two things. We take a hydrogen at the zinc site. Here's another example here. We make a potential mapping of all the contour lines for it. It's shown over here. That's at one orientation. But we also do it as a function of rotation, which is shown here for the zinc site and for the oxygen site. And then we use that information to calculate the zero point energy, and we map the angular potential in the spherical. I think I have that shown next slide in the spherical harmonics and solve the Schrödinger equation. You get those zero point energies. And that just shows the spherical harmonic mapping. But they come out well. Okay, now the real test was, they'd done inelastic neutron diffraction. What they did was to send in neutrons, but they filled this structure with parahydrogen. That's the singlet hydrogen with the spins opposing each other. Okay, and that's the stable form at low temperatures. This was done at 4K. And, of course, the neutron, the spin-flip scattering cross-section for the neutrons is, two orders of magnitude larger than the direct one. So you always get a transition to the singlet. And, they got all this wild structure here. you know, if the singlet weren't split, then all these things would be delta functions at around 15 MeV. And, well, they do it at two different loadings, 1.6 hydrogen per zinc, which is some funny number per unit cell. They weren't very thoughtful of us, but so we didn't do those actual loadings. But I can show you we were able to do them. The experimentalists couldn't make head or tail about what the things were, and you know we could identify the three things associated with the triple splitting at the zinc site and also at the oxygen site, and we could even get the numbers fairly well. Let me show you. Okay, here's the low loading one where there aren't, it's basically nothing at the oxygen site. And what I'm showing you here is there's three different peaks here identified with the zinc site. And this is a prediction of our theory versus experiment. It's not great, but it's not too bad either. And if you go to higher loading, then where you have this curve up here, then you have all this stuff occupied, and we can predict the position of this peak, this peak, this peak, this peak, this peak, and even that peak is split because some cases the oxygen site next to it is occupied, sometimes it isn't. You get a splitting from that, and that we get okay too. You know, so it's, you know, rough agreement, but it's probably good enough so it's right. Okay, so this just says the same thing as before. Okay, so what's in store for improvements on this? So, and I guess there's two approaches. One is to involve, you know, we've been using RevPBE for all of this since the beginning of time on this. And, you know, so and maybe you develop a more appropriate exchange functional, and Valentino Cooper has a preprint on that. Another thing, something that we've been doing is to try to develop an exchange functional that would better match Hartree-Fock, and then try to improve VDWF to work with Hartree-Fock. As far as the exchange functional goes, Kahneman and Becca found that PW86 worked best with the interaction between rare gas atoms. And recently we've extended that for you know a number of small molecules and found that that was the case. Let me tell you a little bit about that. Okay, so what I'm showing you here is the exchange for two crossed hydrogen atoms, ions, moving apart from each other, like this. And it's analyzed according to the reduced gradient S, defined in the usual way down here. And what's shown here is the fraction of the gradient-dependent exchange energy that is produced by S values that are less than what's here. So the final converged value is what you get out here, and I've shown it for several different functionals. And you see, very large S, much larger than we're used to, is necessary. This is the most extreme case, really. I mean, for benzene, it would be half this, but it's still much larger than what we're used to. And the functionals that do best are this PW86 or Becca 86B, the ones that have ever increasing enhancement factors. And the reason for that, we can find the reason for that if we go back to an old paper by John Harris, where he looked at, this is the helium atoms, He defined an overlap function in terms of, not real wave function, but density functional variants of it. And if you do things exactly, in other words, within Hartree-Fock, the dependence on this overlap, as it gets smaller and smaller as you move things apart, is proportional to m squared, both for the kinetic energy and for the exchange energy. Of course, if you do it in LDA, then exchange energy doesn't vary as m squared, it's m to 4/3, that thing always dominates and gives you spurious interaction. Okay, now GGAs can cancel this, right? And it can happen if the enhancement factor is increasing sufficiently rapidly with S, right? Because the overlap decreases S giving repulsion as you go out. But if the enhancement factor flattens off, like it does in say Rev PBE or PBE, then you get to a region where where it becomes like LDA with a bigger coefficient. So LDA, so the GGA actually makes it worse when this happens. Okay, and so here's an example of why that happens. Here's for the crossed functionals, the crossed hydrogen atoms. The black line is Hartree-Fock. The nice purple line here is PW86. And things like Rev PBE has spurious attraction down here. It's quite a ways away. Rev PBE or PBE down here is even worse. It's like this for other things too. I mean, we've done did quite a few atoms, quite a few molecules. Okay, so now let me go on to, so the idea is we're going to use that now and use this now with a different version of the correlation functional. And let me show you what happens when we do this now on the S22 basis set, which let me remind you what that is. It's a set that's been developed by a bunch of people. It has hydrogen bonded complexes and dispersion dominant complexes and mixed complexes there. And we've tested new and old versions on this set. Now these slides contain unpublished data, so I have to tell Doug or whoever it is that takes care of this, and I've had conferences with him. So stuff that goes on here shouldn't be on any websites or anything. It has unpublished data and may change, but I'm just giving you a flavor. That's all.
Thank you, David.
Can you apply this technique also to extended layers, which are van der Waals bonded? I'm thinking of graphene in different configurations.
Graphene?
Yeah. No problem.
Well, there's no problem. There's no problem applying it. I mean,
I'll show you an example, which is a challenge.
Matthias.
Yeah. No. I mean, the I don't know. I mean, we have a case with just with graphite. I mean, the quantum Monte Carlo and the experiment are such as we have are violently different, the results we have, I mean, this is a case that we shouldn't really be doing, right? Because it's it has these funny metallic features. But, I mean, that doesn't stop us from doing it. And you get an answer that's consistent and binding with experiment, but the as usual, the spacing is too big. We haven't done, well, the new version, the spacing gets better, but, you know, I mean, I don't want to push these because, I mean, I'm worried about doing metallic things because...
One question on your new functional. I mean, you showed us the bonding region somehow, yeah. But you didn't really show us the asymptotic region. Now, the original functional, and actually also the new one, certainly if you would do it in an atomic resolved way, you would say it has this correct 1 over r to the 6 behavior, yeah. In the asymptotic.
Yeah.
But the old one had a coefficient which was something 20% wrong or so. How is the new one doing in the asymptotic behavior?
Well, we haven't. Well, I mean, I showed we haven't done the asymptotic calculation separately yet. I've showed you some numbers for a couple of them where it was extended way out. If my which looked pretty good, but my sense is that probably the asymptotic numbers, the actual numbers, are not going to be improved that much when you go way out. But I don't know that yet.
Okay, thanks.
So were you still using the electron gas plasmon pole with the new approach?
Yeah, yeah. There's some variations in.
Okay, just wanted to be sure what was different. Yeah. What's the...
Well,
later.
Later. I'm not talking about that yet because it may, you know... I'm just showing you their possibilities for improvement without... And so I'm not pushing this as a solution yet.
David, the leading correction to minus C6 over R to the 6 is minus C8 over R to the 8.
Yeah.
Have you looked to see if your functional gives that kind of correction to the asymptotics?
No, we haven't looked at that.
So the classical example of van der Waals system is rare gas dimers, right?
Yeah.
And in principle, if you have a perfect correlation functional, or a van der Waals functional, then if you couple it to Hartree-Fock, you should get the right results, right? So what is your opinion on why the errors for rare gas dimers are really the worst?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, they've been bad for small systems, and you know, it's also true for the methane dimer, is our worst case in the S22 set, and I don't really know. I mean, of course, we have sort of a smooth kind of dispersion relationship that implies a lot of, you know, a lot of nearby excitations, and you know, I haven't analyzed the extent whether you have them or not have them, but I mean, it sounds less likely in a rare gas thing that our model would match that as well as in a much larger system. And that's speculation, but
If you look at a rare gas trimer, I believe that beyond after the sum of the van der Waals, there's a new effect, which is the... I'm over here, David.
Oh, yeah. It was coming out back here.
Okay, so the trimer has the Axelrod Teller term,
yeah.
Which is the next order three-body, intrinsically three-body interaction. Can you... I have the impression it's not that small. And I wonder if you've looked at that kind of thing.
Not specifically, but you know, I mean, I guess the closest thing I've gotten is, you know, various layers and graphene and stuff like that, and whether you can you know, add the results of one layer and that layer and then put another one in and just add them separately. And as far as we can see, it's almost indistinguishable, which would mean, at least in that case, that the actual rod teller thing probably is not so big. Yeah, it has another.
So would that be because the axle rod teller is small, or is it because there's a cancellation?
Well, I don't know that. I don't know that. We haven't made any kind of systematic sort of axle rod teller. Ashcroft and Repsevich, who had a version that was very similar, didn't quite get it right, but it was very similar to one of our very early versions for getting C6, and they had some calculations of axle rod teller there, but I would have to go back and look at that. But I suspect it's not as big as what you think. But.
My question was very much related, which was just in general, subtracting off two body forces, taking something bigger and subtracting off two body contributions and getting three body contributions and so forth. Have you done any of that at all in any context? Because it's of great interest for modeling with force fields and so forth.
No, we haven't. Well, I'm kind of interested in that. What would be a good system to try that on?
Well, I think you should talk with Ken Jordan, water hexamers and so forth would be a very good test case because there's a huge amount of interest, obviously. Ken, do you want to comment?
There are several systems where one has used symmetry-adapted perturbation theory approaches to get estimates of the three-body, different three-body contributions. The inert gas is particularly challenging because it's dominated by the dispersion. But in the case of systems like water, the three-body is really dominated by induction. But there are several examples out there in the literature. It would be very interesting to look at.
Okay, I have another question. In the middle of your talk, you mentioned, you're using REF-PBE for your description to correct them as known. Now, you mentioned actually other people are using PBE or Becker 86 or whatever. Now, could you just comment again? I didn't get that. Does that make sense? I mean, what you're doing then, if you would really change your standard functional, that means you correct the whole thing, which to some extent should be correlation by fudging your exchange. So the question is actually what is the justification of REF-PBE and what are the others really doing?
Well, you know, we decided on REF-PBE very early for really the same reason that the other functionals were giving spurious attraction. I mean, we knew about that issue, and we did a trial calculation PW 91 and REV-PBE. REV-PBE was much closer to Hartree-Fock, and so that was the original justification for picking that. We just stayed with the same functional for a long time just so we could see how well it does. I mean, originally it was hard to do calculations.
But the PBE you mentioned was even used by Langres, I believe, right, for some surface calculations. By Lundqvist.
Well, but I mean,
it's too close a name. I'm sorry.
You'll have to ask him. I mean,
yeah, but
actually, yeah, I mean, so the way you say, can't stop people from you can't stop people from doing that, right? I mean, okay. They don't like how well this does, so they make all the, you know, I mean, I've seen a preprint with where people take linear combinations of all different kinds of PBE, you know, things and use them with a functional. And so, yeah, you know, I mean.
Okay, David, one small question. What would your function do if you study proton transfer in biomolecules? Would it improve or transfer between two biomolecules? Or because this is dispersion related, and then it involves also this fact that you have to break the bond and move the proton to the other side.
No. I just don't know enough. I haven't thought about that enough to. I can't make a comment.
Even water.
I'm afraid we
have
to move on.
Lots of important problems that we haven't thought about.
So then, thanks, David, again. Next speaker is Alexandra Tachenko from the FHA.